Hi, everybody. Welcome back. It's Vox Pop, and I'm Alan Chartok. And a new study this month by Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Health says a majority of Americans think of opioid abuse as a criminal justice issue rather than a medical issue. But what is it really? Joining us to discuss the opioid crisis is Dr. Jennifer Michaels, a wonderful, wonderful woman, medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for over 15 years. We should do a big send out to our friend Dave Phelps at the Albany Medical Center, at the Berkshire Medical Center. Thank you, dear Jennifer. I'm so tired. Who is a great guy and who is proud of you and all the incredible work you're doing. Dr. Michaels, Dr. Jennifer Michaels, welcome back to the Vox Pop.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Alan. Great to see you, too.
Well, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. People, you're on enough here so that people will start to talk.
Hopefully good talk, positive talk.
You can also post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Jennifer Michaels, there are stereotypes about people who get addicted. And you have a private practice, of course, and you have your incredible work at the Breen Center as medical director. So you've seen a lot of this. There is a real uptick now in addiction, is there not?
Yes, yeah, a huge uptick. And people are calling it an epidemic, a health crisis, and it is.
And do we know why?
You know, we have a perfect storm of issues that really it germinated in the 1990s. With our focus on pain, and we started to treat pain at any cost,
right.
And now we're paying the price. And also, pharmaceutical companies began promoting opioids for mild to moderate pain.
Hmm.
And believe it or not, OxyContin was released as a less addictive opioid because it was time-released. And
less addictive than what?
Than other opioids. So it was considered to be safer than
name another one.
Than Vicodin or Percocet because it was time-released. And it probably took an addict about 5 seconds to realize if I crush up this pill, I remove the time-release mechanism, and it's a fast release. And the faster you release a substance, the more addictive it is.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have this problem because people believe once you're an addict, you're always an addict. True or not?
You know, it's true that once you have that disease, you have it for life, but it's like any other disease that it can be active or in remission. So, for example, if you have diabetes, you can have a very high blood sugar and have all the consequences, or if you're actively taking care of it, it's present but not active.
Right.
And addiction is the same thing, that you can take care of it and be responsible and vigilant every day, and it's in remission then. And you can have a wonderful life. I get to see all the wonderful lives of recovery. You probably hear about the disaster lives of active addiction.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, we hear about people like, Miles Davis, who walked in to decided, okay, I'm kicking this monkey
mm-hmm.
off my back, and did. You know, went through hell, came out. Is that the way to do it?
You know, it's the way to do it maybe for Miles, but for most people, they will relapse after doing that. 90% of people will relapse after a short detox. So that's inadequate treatment. And we're fortunate we have a lot of treatment options today. Less than 10% of people are in treatment who need treatment.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. And is there a socioeconomic factor in this? In other words, people who get addicted to heroin, for example, which is the next thing up. We keep hearing that opioids come first, and then they find out that that heroin will do the same thing. And we also hear that doctors overprescribe these opioids. I know that when I had my back operations, they gave me opioids.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought them to the police station.
You are so good, Alan.
Well, no, I'm a good boy.
You
never
good.
Took one,
uh-huh.
But I don't even like, I have this rotator cuff. I don't even want to take, ibuprofen because, this stuff isn't always supposed to be so good for you. But there are a lot of people took it and then went on to heroin.
Yes. And so about, first of all, you asked a lot of good questions. It's hard to focus on one, but about 75% of the people who are using heroin now started out with opioid pills. So opioid pills for the majority of people, was the gateway to heroin.
So say that again, 70%.
75% of the people who are now using heroin initiated their opioid use with pills.
Is that right?
Yeah. So Pills start the addiction. They're really expensive. You need more and more over time to get the same effect. And so you graduate to heroin, which is cheaper and very potent.
Wow. Okay. Let's go to Chris in Catskill. All right, Chris, you're on. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a comment on... it's kind of funny how you said you brought him to the police station. Why didn't you just bring the doctor to the police station who gave him to you? But I'm just joking. Let's put it in one step further. Why don't you go to the pharmaceutical companies and bring them to the police station?
Yeah. I hear you, and I hear your tongue in cheek. However, yeah. I think it's good that you bring it to the police station. The only problem I have with the police station, somebody told me something the other day about this, is very interesting, is I have an ongoing campaign because when I went to the police station, I said, can I have a receipt, please? I said, no, we don't give receipts. That, of course, is a problem. I'll tell you right now.
So when I told them, if you're looking to get your money for it, then you probably can go on the street and get it even more. So back on the receipt.
Well, I'm not that cynical, but I think the potential exists. So so I have to say, somebody said the other day, what you do is you take coffee grinds and put them in there with the OxyContin, and that stops the potency of the pills.
I don't know about that, but I'd also just like to make another comment on just broadly about the legislation that dealing with the supply of the drug itself, the availability to the public. What would your personal opinions be on the first step you'd be able to take and sort of hinder this process? I feel like that's where it's first starting. Obviously, like you said, 75% of the people that are on heroin right now started with pills. Where did that come from? Came from a pharmaceutical company. So it's pretty simple to track back, but what would be some of your opinions on how to hinder this process using the legal system?
Using the legal system, well, there's something called the prescription monitoring program, and that monitors people and their prescriptions for 6 months or a year, depending on the state. And so states are beginning to mandate that physicians look at the PMP, the prescription monitoring program, before prescribing opioids. So that will help. But we also have to help doctors to change their habits. And I just want to give you a quick example. One of my friends told me how her son had had a tooth removed and got 60 Percocets.
Wow.
Could you imagine, this 17-year-old child had a tooth removed and got 60 pills. And that is really common.
Yes, and doctors get addicted to Percocet, don't they, sometimes?
We all do. We all do. And so prescribe it. We develop our habits, and it's so hard to change a habit. We need to start giving doctors and dentists feedback.
Would you really call that a habit, though? I mean, the 60 pills is just the ability to be able to prescribe something like that is a little bit past the point of habit. I think it's just the fact that you're able to do it.
Well, let's put it this way, that we develop a style of prescribing that we need to help them change. And it's something that maybe they learned in the 1990s and they need to change. It's a habit in that it's a style of treating people that's antiquated and it's actually harmful to the patient and to society.
Well, but of course, wait 1 second, Chris. But of course, of course, we understand that doctors are concerned about their patients. So if Alan has a back operation, what are they going to do? Say take a baby aspirin?
No, but my thought would be I would give you a 3 or 4 day supply, and then if you're still in pain, I want to see you. I'm not going to give you a month supply because why would I do that? If the operation should lead to a few days of pain and you're still in pain, I want to see you, and that's better treatment.
Okay, Chris, very quickly.
My closing comment would be: you're obviously going to hear the tongue in my cheek, but I would like to say that I think they learned this habit primarily from the pharmaceutical companies. In a non-conspiratorial way, I think it's very clear where it's coming from. Me personally, I had to deal with this epidemic in my family, completely ripped my family apart. And I do want to point a finger somewhere, so that's where the tongue in my cheek is coming from. But anyway, thank you for the call.
And Chris, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I just want to say the other part, too, is that governmental agencies focused on under-treatment of pain. And, for example, the VA called pain the fifth vital sign. And so I call it the perfect storm because it was pharmaceutical companies, physicians, and also the government that promoted pain relief. And we did it in the worst way because opioids are terrible for pain relief in the long term.
Okay. Hey, that was Chris from Catskill. We'll take him down off the board and we'll be right back. We're going to take a very short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Boyden and Pear in Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. Putnam County Tourism, historic sites, farm-to-table dining, kayaking, hiking, biking, and more. Putnam County, where the country begins. Online, visit Putnam.org for event calendar. Coldham and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability. Designed for the next 100 years. CNHArchitects.com. And Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design, and development and graphic design for almost 3 decades. ShannonRose.com.
And we are back here with the wonderful Dr. Jennifer Michaels. Let's take some more calls. We got 4 phones ringing off the hook. That leaves 1 left. Okay, we'll go to Tony and Lee. Tony and Lee, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I'm concerned about the flip side of all of this. My wife has arthritis and lives in with chronic pain, and she needs narcotic pain medication to approximate a normal life. Characterization of this as a crisis and talking about doctors overprescribing is making life more complicated and more difficult for us. I could tell you some stories about, you know, not being permitted to get enough medication to last through a vacation, and being told, you know, the insinuations of pharmacists and that somehow my wife is abusing the medication by following her doctor's orders. It's really a problem.
Jen?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is true. And, you know, that's the flip side, exactly what you said. And there is a monitoring system in place where patients now have to do urine toxicologies to, you know, confirm that they're taking their medicine and not taking other substances. We're checking that PMP to make sure that they aren't getting other prescriptions. And so it's making it hard for people who have valid severe pain.
And what's PMP again?
Prescription Monitoring Program. Okay. That's that record of prescriptions that people are getting. So I'm sorry. And I think it is a big problem that people with valid severe pain are having difficulty sometimes getting the treatment they need.
Sometimes, you know, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. I mean, I think, yeah. Tony, you make a very good point. Do you have one particular horror story you want to tell us?
Well, I guess the worst thing that happened is that someone did steal her medication once, and she needs the medication to live, to make it through the day. And, you know, trying to get a prescription filled after the drugs have been stolen was incredibly difficult.
No, and that can happen, that, you know, that the doctors have become suspicious. It's our pain clinic has sometimes a 3 to 4 month wait because people don't want to treat pain, and so specialists are needed, and the specialists are overcome by the number of patients needing pain management.
Okay, Tony, thank you for the very good call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Alex in Amsterdam. That's a alliteration. Go ahead, Alex. You're on.
How you doing? I'd like to talk about the insurance companies. I believe that the insurance companies always ask the doctors to try to treat as conservatively as possible. And because you're in pain for a long period of time, you're exposed to a lot of pain pills until something happens. It happened with me. I had a back problem, problem with a tree, and it was several years until I got an operation. But in that period of time, I had a lot of prescriptions over and over and over and over. And it caused me a problem until my back was gone. So how do you think the insurance company wants the doctor to treat things so conservatively and you have to have pain pills until that time? I wonder how that fills part of the story.
Well, you know, doctors have a lot of latitude when they decide about treating you. And so I don't know that I would blame the insurance companies. And perhaps that was the easiest thing to do, to write you a prescription. It takes about 10 seconds to write a prescription for opioids. It takes about 15, 20 minutes to fully evaluate your source of pain and make a referral for surgery. And so I think because of a variety of factors, more people are getting pills and delaying appropriate treatments.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Greg in Pine Bush. Okay, Greg, 1-800-348-2551. Greg, you're on.
Hi, I just wanted to speak on what she just said, how it takes a doctor 15 seconds to write a script, but 15 minutes to do maybe a full evaluation and to properly diagnose the patient. I believe the doctors are very much to blame. My sister started off with prescription pills, and she eventually moved on to the heroin. But, you know, if you have a doctor who lines up patients that he knows are going to be in and out, you don't need to be put in a gown. He doesn't need to get his hands dirty. He can just say, hi, how are you doing? Okay, nice to see you. Here's your usual. Have a nice day. It keeps his docket full for the day, keeps his paycheck nice and fluffed up, keeps his bosses happy that his patients are coming in and out and requesting him. And that's really it. I think the doctors are very much to blame in this.
So let me ask an ancillary question, Jen, if I may. You know, in the old days, your psychiatrist, would spend, 40, 50 minutes with a patient. Then along came pills. And I don't think they spend 40 or 50 minutes with a patient anymore, not all of them. Some of them have basically drug practices, right?
Yes, and length of time with patients vary. I can tell you when I moved to my current position, I was in shock that I wasn't going to see patients for 50 minutes. It took me a big adjustment to realize that I had 20-minute appointments. Now, I've adjusted to that. I work with therapists. But there is this pressure to produce. And insurance companies will only reimburse for brief visits. And I think all doctors are struggling with that. And patients are struggling.
Right. Well, Greg, you make a good point, and we're sorry about your sister, and we are sorry. But we are, as you say, or I think you said, we're in the middle of an epidemic. There's no two ways about it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, hey, I appreciate it, and that's it. I just wanted to make that little drop in.
And you did.
I remember the first time I brought my sister to, it was a detox facility with a 30-day rehab. I remember sitting down with her, going through her phone, trying to get rid of any contacts. And I said, listen, let's go to your doctor. I pulled a couple of prescription bottles. I said, let's go see these two doctors that you're going to see. We made the appointments. We went in. And I told the doctor specifically, don't write her any more scripts. She has a problem. We're taking her to a place for help. And I dropped in a little comment like, how dare you? She's been coming to you for years for these pills. You know better. And both of the doctors I said that to turned white. Everything was going good until I said that. They turned white. They knew it was the truth. I could see it in their eyes. And that's been my stance ever since. The doctors are very much to blame.
Okay, there's a lot of blame to go around if you think about it. There's the doctor, there's the doctors, there's the drug companies, and then of course there are the people who decide that they're going to play around with this stuff.
Absolutely. Know that the majority of doctors are not prescribing these pills. It's a small minority prescribing the majority of the pills. And
yeah,
I think we need to help them. The government needs to give them feedback about their prescribing practices.
Okay.
Agreed. All right, guys. Thank you very much. Great show.
And thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551. And you can write to us at VoxPop at WAMC. Hi, Alan. Why do you want a receipt for your pills? Well, because I'm a little paranoid. I want to make sure that somebody knows that I did the right thing and turned them in. And also, I want the police who are collecting this stuff not to use it for other purposes, if you're sort of following. I'm not saying they are. I'm not making the accusation. But I think a receipt would be a good way to prevent that from happening. Joe on Facebook says, the white
buprenorphine
doesn't have an inhibitor. women on the program will get pregnant to get these, and if not on a program, will get pregnant to move up on the list, as a fetus would take priority. Has any research been done into this adverse side effect of the rehabilitation program?
Ooh, that's a stretch.
You mean you get pregnant in order to get the
medication? Yeah. So I work in Massachusetts. I have not seen that at the Breen Center at all. What I see is that when people are sober, they're more likely to be fertile, and they are surprised to find out they're pregnant a few months after initiating treatment. I do not see people getting pregnant to get pure buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. Interesting idea.
Both my brother, age 36, and my niece, age 34, died from cancer. In both cases, the doctors would not, A, prescribe narcotics because it could, quote, cause addiction, or B, only prescribe a small amount for a lengthy period of time. It was a nightmare scenario they wouldn't have believed had I not been there to witness it. The suffering was unbearable to watch, and there was next to nothing any of us could do. They simply suffered. I've listened to lawmakers talk passionately about stemming the flow of narcotics, and all I can think of is the horrific effect this kind of narrow-mindedness may encompass.
So that's, I wonder if those people passed away recently or decades ago, because that was the erroneous practice, you know, in the 1980s or so. And hospice now is wonderful at helping people to die with minimal pain with opioids. And that's when it's most appropriate. End of life pain. I'm just very sorry that those two relatives had that experience. Yeah. They should not have that experience. No one should.
We'll go to Kathy in Cooperstown. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm just about to go under some big cables. Okay, I guess that's not cutting out. Hi, I'm a retired physician, and I just wanted, though, to speak to the physician's prescribing habits, that in general, when you are prescribing a diuretic or a thyroid medication or something like that, you prescribe for a month, and the insurance companies will fill the prescriptions for a month. I'm not sure. I have the impression that some insurance companies may not fill a second prescription within a month for certain things. Maybe your guest can speak to that. But I think too many times the doctor then, in prescribing the pain medication, is just thinking, okay, here's somebody, you know, let's give 30 pills just like we always do. And clearly doctors do need re-education on that score, but there are many patients who have chronic pain who do need month-long prescriptions. And so it's not just a clear doctors should never do this, but I certainly agree that doctors and dentists need to be really thinking carefully about, you know, how many days.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, first of all, doctor, thank you for calling. And other doctor, do you want to react to that?
I prescribe buprenorphine, and I can prescribe 1 day or 10 days, and I don't have any problem having insurance companies pay for various amounts. So I think we need to tailor the amount for the clinical situation.
Yeah.
And an insurance company should not dictate how we prescribe. I think clinical appropriateness, evidence should dictate that. But I agree that I think doctors are under that. Some doctors have a bad habit of prescribing for a month at a time. I totally agree with you. And when I talked about habits before, those are the habits we have to change.
Kathy, thank you for calling. You can answer the phone. I heard it ringing. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go to Christine in Mount Tremper. Okay, Christine, you're on.
Hello, doctors. I just wanted to say that I live with chronic pain every day. I have severe osteoporosis, spinal stenosis, degenerative disc disease, but I cannot take opioids. They don't agree with me at all. They make me sick. And what is the alternative? I am on a prescription ibuprofen, but after a while, my doctors are worried about my stomach reaction.
And your kidneys.
And my kidneys, yes, yeah. to say the least. So I'm just wondering, what is the alternative? I mean, to go to physical therapy, it takes me over an hour to get there by Medicaid taxi. They give you a very short period of time, and then it, by the time I get back, any effects that the physical therapy have had on me are blown away because I'm still in so much pain from having to be dragged all over God's green earth for therapy. And I'm just wondering what the alternative is. And I also wanted to speak to you about the therapy thing, the psychologist. I tried to go to a psychologist and found that the same thing. It takes me an hour to get there, and I get 20 minutes. And that's barely enough to tell them my name and statistics. Yeah. Before they sent me out the door again.
Okay, Christine, I don't want to interrupt, but we have a lot of people behind you. So, Dr. Michaels?
Well, alternatives to opioids. I'm not a pain expert, but some of my patients have benefited from acupuncture. And there are also anti-seizure medications like Neurontin, Topamax, Lyrica, medications like that can be effective. And there are other specialty medications that a pain doctor could help you with. So I recommend you see a physiatrist or a pain doctor. As far as therapy for pain, mindfulness-based stress reduction.
I do a lot of that. Okay. I have no choice.
That has been shown to reduce pain. And I recommend if you can't travel, get an app, download something on your phone, or go online to mindfulness-based stress reduction for pain relief.
What is it, Jen?
It's a way of learning to cultivate pathways in your brain that kind of connect you to the present situation. And
I do that quite often.
And how does it work for you? How is it?
It does work. It does work, but not all the time. Mm-hmm. As you know, living with pain is quite exhausting.
Yeah, it is. Christine, thank you for calling. Appreciate
thank
it.
You, folks.
Bye.
Thank you.
We'll go to Wanda in Gilderland. Okay, Wanda.
Hi. My sister was a drug addict, and she has since passed away. And when she was so very good, she could have won an Academy Award. And she would go into doctors, and she would get them to prescribe her anything she wanted. She would bat her blue eyes at them, and they would give her anything. From a doctor's perspective, how good at people who are addicts at basically bamboozling doctors into giving them whatever they want? And can you blame a doctor who believes somebody who is very sincere in asking or knowing all the right answers when they ask about pain? I don't really think that you can blame a doctor if somebody comes in and is so very sincere and knows the answers, and then they walk out with a prescription for opioids. Do you see that in your practice?
Well, I think if you're an active addict, your job is to get drugs. And so you will go to a doctor and use your skills. And many addicts are very adept at getting drugs. And I will sometimes say to my patients, if you use your skills for obtaining drugs to getting sober and staying in recovery, I say to them, I'll be working for you in 5 years because you are so skilled at working with people and getting what you want. And it's really true. So it's not just the doctors, but it's almost like a collusion of patient and doctor that promotes the ongoing addiction.
Well, that's what Alan was saying a few minutes ago. It's not just the drug companies. It's not just the doctors. It's a complete there's a whole circle. You can't just attack one thing. You can't just say, well, it's the doctors or it's the prescription drug companies or it's this, it's that. It's a complete thing. And you can't just attack one little piece of it. It's got to be a complete, you got to have a strategy that'll go after every little thing. I used to say to my sister, how can you get all these drugs? And her response was, I'm very good at what I do. Yeah. Thank you for this program. It's very enlightening.
Wanda, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
It's enlightening. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye.
Thank you, Wanda.
Yeah. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We have three people on the phone, but I do want to take a short break so we can come back, finish the program, and give everybody as much time as we can. So let's take a little break now. Okay, Zach?
Support for WAMC comes from Waterwheel Village in Galway, New York, wishing WAMC listeners a happy holiday season. Now shipping extra sharp New York cheddar, imported meats and cheeses, and nostalgic candies. WaterwheelVillage.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. nature.org/Adirondacks. East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa, Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs. Massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com. Albany Realty Group, a local woman-owned real estate company since 2003, educating and counseling sellers and buyers throughout the real estate transaction, albanyrealtygroup.com. And Curtis Lumber, specializing in deck and dock design featuring Trex composite decking and railings, pressure-treated wood, and more. Design consultation available, curtislumber.com.
And we are back with the wonderful Dr. Jennifer Michaels. Jen, in the time we had while we were listening to the underwriting, you mentioned that Massachusetts has a campaign so that people who have learned to live with their addiction or changed or gotten over the hump have been doing ads saying, look, I'm an addict and I'm still a functioning member of society.
Yes, and stop the stigma. You know, and I said before that, you know, we have billboards of people who recover from cancer, but there's no one on a billboard recovering from addiction. And yet, you know, I have hundreds and hundreds of patients who are doing beautifully in the world. And so we need to stop the stigma so we can hear the success stories. Those people are role models. They normalize this disease and they're out there. It's just they're the silent group right now.
Let's go to Enrique. Okay, we're going to try to get everybody in. It's going to mean we're going to keep our questions and answers short. Okay, Enrique, you're on.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that from the way that I see things is we've become a very opiophobic society where pain is being undertreated. I've read many, many articles about that. What is the difference between addiction and dependence? Why does it matter if an elderly person, like my 89-year-old father, starts taking morphine because he's passing away? And then there's people that live day in, day out with chronic pain, and they need the meds. It changes their lives. It allows them to have a life. I feel a lot of compassion for that. My goodness, we have the drugs available. A few people in society many people in society have abused that privilege, but there are still people that need this medication to get by.
Yeah, some people do need the medication, especially end-of-life pain. We need to give people who are dying the comfort with opioids, and that we know that.
Yeah,
and
that one's clear. It's the people that live with pain constantly that I feel are being stigmatized, and it seems so unfair to me that the media has whipped up this storm, or I don't know why all of a sudden, but... Yeah. It's this stigma about, oh my gosh, you know, you take this and it's like, well, guess what? It allows me to mow the lawn. It allows me to walk my dog. It allows me to live my life.
So part of the problem with opioids is they don't address the source of pain. They make your brain not care that you're in pain. And some studies have shown that for chronic, non-malignant pain, staying on opioids actually reduces your functionality. Mm-hmm. And so it's tempting to say, you know, somebody has back pain, they should be able to take an opioid, but it doesn't really solve the problem, and it can worsen the problem because you're not aware you're in pain, you run around, you mow the lawn when you shouldn't be because pain is a useful signal, and so opioids can compound the problem. When rest or heat or, you know, ice can be the answer, or Tylenol or Motrin.
Oh, yeah, no, anti-inflammatories, ice are one's best friend. But there are situations where it is needed, and
yep.
I Anyway,
so it's a matter of balance.
That's the point I wanted to make.
So it's a matter of balance, right, Enrique?
I agree. Yeah. I totally agree.
Okay.
And it's a question of not abusing that balance. And
but I must say, I'm very respectful of what you said about your father being able to take it at the end of life. But you have somebody in the middle of life who's suffering from chronic pain. Look, people commit suicide, among other things, because of this, not being allowed to do it. It's a very good point, Enrique, and I respect it a lot. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Yep, bye.
Okay, let's go to Sheila in Pocown, Poughkeepsie. All right, Sheila, you're on. Sheila. Hello, Sheila.
You've got Jules here.
Jules, there you are. I must have pressed number 4 instead of number 5. Okay, we'll take Sheila next. Jules, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Okay, thanks, Alan. Very good, and appreciate this program. My question has to do with pain management in general. I mean, I understand that there appears to be a fair amount of chronic pain reported these days that the people are suffering, but I don't hear a lot about specialists in pain management. I know there are some, but I'm wondering if one of the things we need are better referrals. If someone comes back to their GP, for example, continually complaining about pain over a long period of time, maybe there should be a referral to a pain specialist, and maybe we need more of those.
It's a good point, you know, Jen. I've been going to physical therapy for my shoulder, and right across the street on Everett Road is a pain management clinic. So they're there, Jules.
And I have spinal stenosis and some low back pain, but I've also been fortunate in that I've been able to use physical therapy and daily yoga exercise to keep that under control. You know, not everybody is so fortunate, but there are alternatives. And you know, how often do we get the opportunity to explore those?
I've always wanted to ask you, Jules, because you and I correspond a lot. How old are you?
75.
Oh, so you and I are about the same age. Okay, right. Very, very good. Jen?
Well, I think you're right. And a good pain specialist, like someone like Dr. Andrew DiMaggio, I work with him at Berkshire Medical Center, he looks at alternatives to opioids because he understands that it's not ideal for chronic non-malignant pain. But he does injections. He refers people to an osteopath. He uses medications that aren't addictive. And I think a pain specialist can be life-saving for someone struggling with pain. So we need more of that.
As always, Jules, thanks for the wonderful call. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Let's go to Sheila now. Sheila, I'm sorry for keeping you waiting. You're up.
That's all right, Alan. I thought that all of the callers have asked very interesting questions and made wonderful comments. Mine is this. We keep talking about who's to blame for all of it. I'm more interested in the question of responsibility. By that, I mean, from the clinical perspective, when physicians are aware that someone is misprescribing or has a habit of prescribing opioids in large quantities or inappropriately, it seems to me that they have a responsibility to their own profession and to the community at large to get that physician to stop behaving that way.
So just like the police. So a policeman sees...
No, I don't think it's they need police themselves. It doesn't mean that you're going to force the person out of their... they can't practice, but if there are standard good practices and clinically accepted modalities and someone is not behaving that way, what are the responsibilities for the medical profession?
Okay, we got it. And over to you, Dr. Michaels.
Well, I think part of the issue is we don't know exactly what our fellow physicians are doing. I mean, I don't know the prescribing practices of all of my colleagues.
At a cocktail party, somebody doesn't come over and whisper in your ear?
No, we don't really know what's going on.
But you could know because there's a database of how physicians are prescribing these drugs.
But it would mean that the fellow doctors would have to be sort of detectives and online.
Well, there are quality assurance, or there are physicians who vet their colleagues when they're being granted privileges. Why is there no review process?
Well, you know,
in other words, I think there are ways in which we are overlooking some obvious pieces of information. We don't have to stigmatize the victims of opioid practice. and the physician and the medical community.
Okay, Sheila,
itself.
Sheila, we get it. We get it. Go ahead, Jen.
So the state currently collects data about prescribing practices, and I would welcome feedback from the state, the Department of Public Health. Right now, they're giving us feedback about patients who are what we call doctor shopping. We're not getting feedback about our profile, our unique prescribing practice. And I would love to see how I compare to my colleagues. And I think it would be useful data for the medical community.
That's a good point. And I should have long ago turned in some of my fellow political scientists for what they were saying. Thank you, Sheila. Good points. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's go to Emmanuel in Glastonbury.
Greensbury, New York. Yes.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Vivian, come back here. I just picked my daughter up. Sorry. An ex of mine was getting her medication. She had been addicted to her migraine pain medicine.
Right.
She was getting it through an online pharmaceutical company who got the prescription written by a doctor in Puerto Rico. Now, how does that go along with the prescription monitoring that's done here, and is there any way to really control that, is really my comment and concern.
Yeah, I think we are missing the boat on with the online prescribing and out-of-state physicians who are writing prescriptions in that way. For example, Massachusetts reports back on prescriptions filled in Massachusetts. And so if my patient crosses state lines and gets it filled in New York, I don't see that information. So we probably underestimate the severity of the problem based on what you're saying.
Good point. Thanks a lot for calling. All right, let's go to Susan in Sunderland. Susan, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about the side effects of opioids. The prescriptions, the opioids frequently cause constipation as a side effect of the drugs. And I have two questions. One is, in my experience and experience with friends, doctors typically do not tell patients to anticipate that this is going to be a problem. So that's one question, is why wouldn't they do that? And my second question is, I've seen on TV now that there's a new prescription drug for constipation associated with opioids. And is there a reason that people couldn't be suggested to just take a regular laxative instead of another prescription drug that the drug companies can make money off of?
Susan, we're really running up against the tide here. Doctor.
Okay, very quickly, all physicians should tell patients about the potential risks, benefits, side effects of all medications. So that's a problem. As far as the constipation goes, you can take something over the counter. You could have a bulkier diet with fruits and vegetables, and then oftentimes people become tolerant to the constipating effects. So,
and water.
Yes, and water. So
well, I understand that, but what I'm saying is, you know, if you're not thinking about this, it might be like two and a half days before you realize, oh, I've got a problem.
Okay,
here.
No. But I think Dr. Michaels said it, Susan. She said, you know, they should do it, but there she thought she'd give you some help in terms of some of the ways that one could do something, because I thought that was one of your questions. Susan, thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. Okay, we'll go to Joe in Pittsfield. Joe, you're on.
Hi, how you doing, everybody?
We're good.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment that it's kind of like a sad state of affairs that we're in as a society as it is. You know, it's like, think about there's gas-powered leaf blowers and the people go to the gym to work out. But it's like, I cut my hand in half, lost a couple fingers during the reconstructive part, and I didn't have any of these big drugs. And I made it through and actually built a little character through the whole process.
So that's your point. Your point is, if you can experience the pain, and I'm not trying to be fresh here, that if you can experience the pain, you might develop a better character.
Absolutely. It's, you know, when you're in a real tough place in your life,
right.
Which, you know, I had this terrible accident, I got through it. You know, it's like the.
So you're calling. So you're calling for character on the part of the people, so that they don't have to take drugs. Jen, did you want to say anything about that?
I just want to ask Joe. Were you offered pills? Did you decide not?
No, this was way back. This was in the 70s when this happened, and there, you know, they didn't have all this stuff they have now. That they'll prescribe. You know, someone has back pain and they give them that oxys. You know, I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
You know, they turn into addicts. And it's just, you know, I do think part of it, too, is criminal. I mean, these guys, you know, they're prescribing things to people that are very, very powerful.
Okay, but it's only criminal when the legislature says it's criminal. Hey, Joe,
yeah, exactly.
Joe, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. We'll go to Jackie in New Paltz. Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi. In regard to your discussion, it's mostly been about physical pain. I'm a mental health patient suffering from bipolar and borderline personality, and I've taken medication for many, many, many years. Recently, my doctor said no more Xanax, even though I use it very sparingly, and he didn't even want to talk about it, and I think that he's responding to the media crisis and probably the professional crisis, but it has been an important part of my treatment and a helpful part of
my
treatment.
Okay, so that's the comment, Dr. Michaels.
Well, I feel badly for you because I think that is part of the consequence of this opioid phobia that we're experiencing is that many doctors are cutting back on some medications like Xanax, a benzodiazepine, or Ativan that help someone like Jackie who has bipolar disorder and a benzodiazepine now and then might be very helpful. So we have to have a balanced approach. I mean, you hear the pendulum, you see the pendulum swinging from one side to the other, and we need the middle ground.
Jackie, thank you for the call. We appreciate it, and we're thinking about you here. Okay, we are just about out of time. Let me read you a couple of the emails, okay? Jen, both my brother... No, that's wrong. We had that one. Okay, here. Really interesting listening to people discussing drug abuse, in quotes, who have less than zero understanding of it from the user's point of view. Arrogant elitist. First, let me say that this attitude has led to this never-ending war on drugs, has most, in capital letters, most, doctors terrified to prescribe painkillers, meaning most people who need it can't get it because of this bass-awkward approach, get it, towards this problem. It isn't a doctor's fault that there are people who self-medicate. It's reality that isn't going away by scaring doctors into not prescribing pain meds when people need it. I mean, if there's one thing that's come out of this program is hearing from a lot of people who really feel that, you know, their needs, they're not addicts, but their needs have been cut off here. If you want to deal with the problem of addiction, restricting the access to drugs does nothing. If you had any understanding why people take drugs, I think you would understand that you folks really don't hang any idea what have hang. It says hang. Have any idea what you're talking about? Well, let me just say you are talking with Dr. Jennifer Michaels, one of the great experts on this issue, and you don't know what you're talking about. Thank you. Jill says, I understand long-term pain. I also understand severe temporary pain. Regarding the latter, with all due respect, if doctor writes for 30 tablets, but you don't have to take the entire script. When the pain becomes intolerable or goes away, stop taking the med. Okay, you know, that presupposes that you don't get hooked, right, Jen?
Yeah, and we're over-prescribing. We know that. And last year we prescribed enough for every adult in the United States to get his or her own vial of opioids. So
really?
we're way overdoing it. And yet there are evidence-based treatments for pain that usually do not involve opioids. So we need to practice evidence-based treatment of pain management, not ignore it and not prescribe opioids routinely.
Well, Jen Michaels, I can't tell you, Dr. Michaels, how much we appreciate your being here always. We're just about out of time, and we have nobody left to apologize to. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for being with us today, and to Dr. David Phelps for allowing her to come over here and educate all of us. Support for Vox Pop comes from Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art. Facebook, or visionexcelicare.com. Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in divorce mediation and collaborative divorce, helping people who are seeking helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce. Offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill. Upstate DivorceMediation.com. The Washington County Tourism and the towns and villages therein, featuring art venues, holiday happenings, farmers markets, craft beverage, and specialty shops for holiday gift giving. Washington and NY County.com. And Clipcentric Albany, a local video service division of Clipcentric, providing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV, Albany, albany.clipcentric.com. Thanks to our wonderful engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Susie Chekai for answering the phones. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a news update.